Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages. I'm Chris Racanello, and I'm a PhD candidate at the CUNY Graduate Center studying art history with Cynthia Hahn. Today, I am so excited to have a conversation with three scholars who are all working on the medievalisms of modern to contemporary Conque. We will discuss how we as scholars participate in history making. We'll discuss the impact of photography on how we've taught and formed the concept of Romanesque. Then we'll also discuss the revival of the cult of Saint-Foix in the 1870s and the imaginaries of revivalist styles in the 19th century and how these affected restoration efforts in Conque itself. We are joining from all over the world, the United States, the Czech Republic, and Germany, and I'm actually currently in Rome. So now I'll let them introduce themselves. So Jan, please.
I'm Jan Marquardt. I'm retired, emerita professor, although I still continue to teach here and there. I did work mostly on historiography of the 11th and 12th century French art. Also work on other topics that enrich my sense of modern consumption of the past.
All right. I am Martin Lesha. Right now, I'm a postdoc. I'm a fellow of Humboldt Stiftung at the University of Regensburg, Department of Liturgical Studies, but my formation is in art history. I've wrote my PhD, which I'm working on publishing at the very moment, on the interconnections between the 9th century monumental mosaic decorations in Rome and the papal stational liturgy.
Thank you, Jan and Martin. Adrian, could you also say a little bit and introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Adrian Palladino, and I'm assistant professor at the Department of Art History at the Masaryk University, where I did my PhD partly between the Masaryk University and the University of Fribourg in Switzerland. I worked on late antique reliquaries from the 4th to the 6th century Common Era. But then I also started already during my PhD to work a lot, like Janet has already spoken about, on the historiography of the field of art history, on various different aspects related to the reception history, but also the way in which the field has constructed itself, the methods, the way in which the field has, let's say, grown throughout the 19th and 20th century, also sometimes with kind of problematic methodological approaches, which today can seem distant. And I'm involved in the big Conque project that we will speak about. And I also just started a new project, which is called Dreaming Byzantium in 19th century France, and which is focused on Neo-Byzantine architecture, Orientalism, and the racial and national myth of art history, focused mostly on France, but looking at these kind of historicist revivals also in other countries. So thank you for having us on the podcast.
Yes, thank you. We are all together working on publishing a book as the final culmination of the Conque project that we've been working on. I am working on chapters, one that's on contemporary Conque, which deals with exhibition histories, chapter on the post-medieval material spread that deals with a case study of the Wendat in Quebec, Canada. And Martin and I are actually together working on processions at Conque, and he'll speak much more about that, I'm sure, in just a few minutes. But I was wondering, Adrian, could you tell us a little about this project that we've been working on?
Yes, please complete what I say, because I will perhaps forget certain aspects. So the project itself, as you said, is born from let's say, a grant of the European Union through a scheme called Marie Curie RISE. The ideas of this Marie Curie project is really based on interdisciplinarity on the one hand, and on the other hand, on integrative research. So on exchange, so an exchange between as many possible partners, different institutions as possible, and as many different fields as possible. So here we are involving in this Conque project mainly art history, but there are also music and performance studies, archaeology, archaeometry. We are using digital technologies to reconstruct parts of the Abbey Church and the inner furnishings. And the team consists of 6 European and 2 American institutions investigating, let's say, the major stages in the medieval construction of Conque, the medieval period, but also going backwards, how, let's say, the medieval story was rewritten in the 19th and 20th century. So a sort of reinvention of the European Middle Ages. And the principal investigator who wrote the project mostly was Professor Ivan Folletti at the Masaryk University, but project partners include the DFK in Paris, the Bibliotheca Hertziana in Rome, the University of Poitiers with the CNRS, the City University of New York, and Rutgers University.
And the point of us being here is to talk about modern and contemporary conch. But maybe I'll say first that conch is an incredibly important medieval site.
Well, I think conch is a place, at least for me, and I think for Martin as well, we arrived walking there in 2017 as pilgrims who were doing a sort of crazy pilgrimage project, but also as art historians, and kind of fell in love with the place, both for its medieval monuments, but also for, I think, the charm, which still today is attracting thousands of tourists and pilgrims every year. A small, very picturesque village, which preserved this appearance. So this, I think, Disneylanding appearance is very important, and we are going to speak about it again. But the perfect appearance of a perfectly preserved little medieval village, which, however, also preserves some of the major monuments for the European Middle Ages that we can find in the territory of France, including breathtaking treasure, a timber reproduced in virtually, I think, every guidebook that we can find, as well as breathtaking architecture.
The importance of conch for the Middle Ages was that it was a pilgrimage destination that was so remote, and it was such a tiny village and small church, even though it was built in the style of the plan designed to welcome pilgrims. It's amazing in a way that it became as famous as it did on one of the pilgrimage routes, because it is so hard to get to. Although, of course, for some pilgrims, that was an attraction. But it didn't have a lot of the elan, if you will, of some of the really big ones and famous saints and urban centers and everything. So our seeing it now as a quaint little village is not that different from what even was in the Middle Ages. I think it would have still been considered a backwater in a way, you know, as opposed to going to, say, Limoges or even Chartres, which was so near Paris or something like that.
Absolutely. And other than the Romanesque church, listeners will probably know conch from the Majesty of Sainte-Foy, which is taught in all art history survey classes still, an extremely important reliquary that was fabricated anywhere, we could say, between 883 and 1100, and then gems and stones are added onto it. So you can probably imagine the face of this reliquary in your minds as we're talking. And Martin, I was wondering too, could you tell us the name of the project, the pilgrimage routes that you walked?
Sure. The project Adrian was talking about already was called Migrating Art Historians. It's a project we did at the Masaryk University of 2017. And the conch was first pilgrimage site we arrived to. So it was the first step. It was incredible there because at the same time, we had great scholars arriving there. We had Siebe de Blau or Hans Belting back then. Obviously, Cynthia Hanna, I shouldn't forget about her. And so this project was very essential, I think, in formation of this second step of the conch project.
If I can jump in, it's really there that we started to realize that conch fits for this kind of project, because it's a site where we have all these different periods together. So both, as Janet mentioned earlier, the fact that this is an important site of pilgrimage starting 11th, 12th century and going through other epochs with the fabulous history of the treasure, which is preserved there, the question of the recreation of the Middle Ages in the 19th century, and all these issues which tied in and were perfect in terms of size and in terms of scope for a larger project. And the site that we found was perhaps the most interesting or the most rich in terms of the variety of questions we could ask was really conch.
Yeah, I just want to say that the community of the Premonstratensians who are there were extremely kind of welcoming, and it shaped the decision of Valetti and Adrian to write this project on conch.
Of course, we've said this is an important medieval site. And for a podcast that's on the multicultural Middle Ages, we are going into the modern and contemporary. But I think that's in part, Martin, because you and your work really brought me into thinking about the revival of the cult at conch and this ritual practice that still happens there every year. Could you just tell us the topic you're working on for the conch book? And maybe tell us the chapter title, if you can.
There are, I think, two topics I'm working on in this project. One is the medieval landscape of Kong, and the landscape obviously is problematic term, so one could say environment too. For the book, I'm participating in chapters, one with Lei Huang and Ivan Fletty. The second one is kind of taking the materials from Liber Miracolorum, but again, it's about the kind of surroundings of the Kong Abbey and how the monastic community is trying to control it through the various processions into the region with the reliquary of Somphua. That's actually the second topic I'm focusing on in this project, is about the 870s and the ritual life, which the renewal of Somphua's cult by Bishop Buchek initiated. I think it was a little bit of frustration with the medieval sources in terms of the question I've asked about how these medieval reliquary in the landscape, let's say, or in the ritual life of medieval Kong Abbey. But I discovered that in the 1870s, there were incredible processions, you know, from Rhodes to Kong, which are described very well. And I felt like, wow, this is so fascinating. You know, you have these medieval objects used in different contexts.
Can you just say for our listeners, who is Bishop Bore, or how would you characterize what Bishop Bore did in the 1870s?
I think he was born in 1827. He had a great formation for a cleric. So he had a PhD writing on medieval Seville, which he, I think, defended in 55 in Paris. And he then was, I think, teaching there at the university as well.
Wow.
So it was this kind of intellectual, which then was suddenly ordained a bishop of Rhodes in 71. But I think with that formation, he was like absolutely at the right moment. He had enough energy, I think, to do this kind of renewal of Somphua, of the cult of Somphua, which actually we have sources for that as well. I'm writing about this a little bit more in my recent article, to create a community, which we like a Catholic community, and resistance to what he and this intellectual milieu of Rhodes, the resistance to this new anti-clerical policy which were accepted in Paris. That's what this intellectual milieu thought was happening. The renewal of Somphua's cult was fashioned in order to fight this. And it started in 1873 when the premonstratensians tensions were introduced to the Abbey of Kong, and they were supposed to be about this renewal of ritual life as well. During the 70s, especially, you know, the medieval reliquaries were also restored in Paris and then returned to Kong as well. And this great procession of 1878, which is called the Triumph of Somphua, when this famous majesty, the statue reliquary of Somphua, is carried 40 kilometers from Rhodes to Kong.
Can I just ask, because I think also for the people listening, why was a renewal needed? Why was a revival needed?
So what's happened with the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century as well, the secularization of France in a way. And so these sites which had such a long history in a way and power as well, their power was taken back. And that happened in Kong as well. So this kind of recharging of batteries of these medieval objects and the ritual lives is a kind of reaction of the Catholic France to that secularization.
Maybe it would make sense to ask Janet now. You know, Jan is dealing with, let's say, a different religious community or the same religious community, but in a very different way and at a different time. So Jan, could you tell us about your chapter that you're writing for the book, and then maybe more broadly about the motivations behind the Zodiac publication? And you've worked on this so extensively, you're the perfect person to ask.
Because I published a monographic study of a series of very influential French books that were produced during the 20th century, Zodiac, and they covered, it was primarily about Romanesque art, it was photographic survey. The most important of the volumes, the main series, was one that was divided by regions. And so I was asked by members of the project to talk about how Kong features in the Zodiac books, and in particular in these regional studies, how it's situated. Because I'm particularly interested in cultural heritage and how art history and images have influenced how we view the past. So the book is named, like all the books in that series, it's the name of the region, and then they had the word Roman in French attached that covers this section. This is the Rouergue. So my chapter is named after that volume called Rouergue Roman, Zodiac Song.
I'm curious both about the extent of Zodiac, but then also the way that you think it influenced the imaginary of Romanesque.
The publication came out of a monastery in Burgundy just after World War II. As one of a few projects, the monastery was trying to bring in some income. They also had a lot of young monks who'd taken their vows during the war to avoid conscription. And so the abbot was trying to keep them busy coming up with these projects. For instance, there is an experimental farm, another periodical that had been founded and edited by the Zodiac founder's older brother. The man who started the Zodiac project got the idea when he had to write a pamphlet defending an exhibit held in 1950 at Vézelay that compared modern art and the medieval art at Vézelay. He had studied with an abstract painter. He was very interested in modernist design. And so he found that he wanted to follow up with that and bring Romanesque art to the public. Now was more ready to receive modernist images because he felt that art was not ostentatious, that was not realistic, ornate like the Gothic, was actually a better conduit for religious and spiritual meditation understandings. After he did that, he started a journal, which he named Zodiac, after the reputations of the months found from classical through Gothic art, also mostly because he liked the calligraphic appearance of the Z and the Q. And this journal was illustrated with black and white photogravure, which are graphic prints of photographs he had taken by a professional. And after a few important local churches, he then put those volumes together and created a book. He borrowed money from his father to publish the first volume, Bourgogne Roman or Romanesque Burgundy, and each volume after that, the income paid for the next one. And at first, the text was written by whomever he knew, usually clergy because they were free, at each location who had some expertise in the site, you know, the art or the history of the site. And then he tried to get other experts equally cheap because they literally didn't have anything to pay for this with. But slowly, as the proceeds grew and it became a recognized publication, they could afford to pay better people and they started getting more serious scholars to improve the reputation of the books. That said, the photographs have always been much more highly regarded than the texts.
I just wanted to jump in and say you're doing a fantastic job of situating us in the actual place. And I wanted to clarify, you've talked about the Rouergue. The Rouergue is a province, an old province, I should say, in France, in the south of France, and it's centered on Rodez. Maybe one of you could pick up, because Rodez is maybe, let's say, a two-day walk to Conques. What's the relationship between Rodez and Conques?
I think it's important to say, just in terms of pure geography, that Rodez is about 40 kilometers from Conques. And obviously, Rodez is the city where a bishop would be seated in terms of it's a religious center into which Conques later on in the 19th century belongs to. In the 1870s, it is the diocese of Rodez which controlled this renewal. So it obviously shows that even the initiative is going from there. Well, in the Middle Ages, I think the dynamic would be certainly different in terms of Conques being such an important pilgrimage site.
Because Rodez was always the head of the diocese. Developed to have, let's say, to have a lot of power because of its relics. But it's all relative. I mean, the whole problem is, again, this kind of interplay between geography and with all possible brackets, the reality, because what we have for Conques are a series of sources which show us that Conques is very powerful and rich, at least at certain moments, especially in the 12th century. Sources which are, of course, to a certain extent, also laudatory for the monks themselves, also in their quarrels with other religious centers around the same region of the Rouergue. But what we have in terms of material evidence in Rodez is still a city which was powerful also at that moment. And Rodez was definitely already the seat. And Conques, as we already discussed, was a spot which is harder to reach, created with the idea of a remote and distant center, which then for some reason starts to become much more attractive and grows to the size of a small city in the 12th century. There are fortifications. We know that there was a blacksmith. We know that they're most likely making reliquaries there as well. So this is a center of a relative importance located in this kind of very hard to reach place up until today.
And I think I'm going to take us back to a second question for Janet, jumping off of your comment on sources. And then, Adrian, I promise I will get to asking you some questions after that. But Janet, you know, I'm always interested in the tension between sources and lived experience and history and the archive. And I just think the subject of Zodiac is such a good example of the tension between the photograph as a document, the photograph as an artistic work. And I wanted to know more about how did you get interested in the publication? And could you also speak about the ways that Zodiac created or disseminated a particular image or an imaginary of the Romanesque?
Well, I guess it all started because when I was an undergraduate, I worked at the UCLA Art Library. This would have been in the early 70s. And patrons would page items from storage. So we'd go back in this area and fetch them, where I discovered duplicate copies of Zodiac books. And so I started taking all my breaks there in these hidden stacks so that I could pore over the images. They just fascinated me. And I'm certain that they affected my preference for Romanesque over Gothic, because they presented, you know, clean architectural lines and whimsical figural abstractions that appealed to me much more than what I mentioned before. I mean, you know, these Gothic attempts at florid exuberance and detailed realism that did nothing for me. And that's the power of a good photograph, particularly when they, you know, a sort of contemporary taste, like the prevalent modernism of the 20th century. Also, the Zodiac, I mean, what probably got me, I was in my 20s, right? The black and white images created a very mysterious and layered atmosphere that fed romantic ideas of the long past Middle Ages. You know, it's a really important feature. They have very deep blacks and many layers that reach back into the spaces, into the narrative forms. And that was evocative. Mm. But the books were, I think, particularly influential at that time because there simply weren't very many photographs of most of the monuments they documented. I mean, yes, the big ones, but a lot of things we take for granted now, there were no photographs. For the art history classroom, Zodiac images opened up, and so we could have lots at our fingertips to represent technology and visual language of Romanesque, which had always been underrepresented compared to Gothic, because in the 19th century, Gothic was all the rage. And of course, the clarity of black and white photographs has always been superior to show architecture and sculpture, and especially these photographs, because they exaggerated contours and surfaces, depths of field, because of the way they were lit and the zooming in of them. So they were ideal for teaching. But then that said, the books simply served themselves with their like wow quality of beauty. I mean, they are artworks themselves. Each of the pages are actual graphic prints. And so a book is a little collection in a reader's hands. They are the originals. There is no, it's not like later where you have a rotogravure or mass production method. These were each printed on a press from a copper plate. It was a very inexpensive way to collect graphic prints in a way. And the monks continued to try to hold on to this technique until there were simply no more printing houses that did it. So the authors, you know, of the essays varied in quality. So if we talk about the academic discourse, you asked how influenced scholarship. Eventually, it did become somewhat of a feather in one's cap to have contributed an essay and all, but it meant that the scholars who were favorites of the Zodiac monks, so, you know, those who either had a relationship with the Abbey or who were very easy to get at a low price or whatever, they influenced the orientation. So whether it was the medieval regional distinctions, which itself is highly debatable, or the way that anything from the 11th to 12th century was labeled Romanesque, or whatever theme a given volume had in, like in the other series, it came mostly out of these people who were writing text for them. The monks were not art historians themselves. They didn't have a nuanced idea of the historiography of the field. So these authors could sway their project, you know, if they were very devout or very nationalistic or something like that. You know, there are a few that stand out in scholarship from the second half of the 20th century, for instance, Francois Henri's trilogy on Irish Romanesque, but most series simply ignore them.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say too, I mean, I completely agree that these are just such beautiful publications, the way they're printed all the way to the edge of the page. And exactly as you said, Jan, the ink on the page. Books aren't produced this way anymore in general, let's say.
They prioritized, it's a very expensive ink. It's bone black, it's called, as opposed to more of a green black or a blue black. And they actually got it from Africa, it's burnt bone, which ties into their colonial project they had. And it brings up a whole nother can of worms. But that was very important to them, to have very rich paper, have very expensive ink, to have the process done by hand. You know, that sort of thing was part of the whole aesthetic of the books.
Yeah, you know, that really brings us into like questions around the primitivism and collaboration with modern art aesthetics, and even the questions about, I mean, the materiality of these are so beautiful, but they also really did affect the way that we think of Romanesque today.
My focus is how cultural heritage is shaped by scholarship. And I think we are the conduit through which cultural heritage is rediscovered and appreciated, right? I mean, many towns only paid attention to their historical monuments or appreciated them after amateur scholarly societies in the 19th century started to write little essays and then read each other's on regional history and make connections with what they had. After all, historians tell the story of the past according to what they wanted to mean for their own, and they interpret it for the public through the lens of their own culture, right? So people could then see their local monument in a fresh way once these historians laid out their worth, and they could get interested in preservation efforts. I mean, Konk is a perfect example of it. It was something that had been pretty much ignored, falling apart. We don't really know exactly what parts of it are still original because so much restoration has been done. The Zodiac books were purchased for and carried by Europeans primarily, and I would say particularly French, all over Europe, going to these destinations on purpose. A lot of people organized their vacations around a Zodiac volume. They were very popular. I actually purchased
them.
It's true. I got a lot of volumes from a complete set that a Swiss couple had accumulated during their life together, and each one is notated with details of their various trips over the years. You know, the books became collection pieces. They were given for significant events like, you know, in a family's life, like a religious milestone or holidays or anniversaries. And the monastery picked up on this and started targeting publication of the books in time for Christmas and Easter and summer vacation. So that's all a way that they could influence the cultural heritage of a particular site. At the same time, we ourselves are shaped by our culture and our past. So just as the books might have affected the appreciation and maybe even literally helped save some historic monuments, so too the monks' focus on these particular monuments came from the fact that they lived in Burgundy. They were Catholic monks whose liturgical practices were modeled upon medieval rituals. They understood the symbolism of the images, most of them. They knew the use of the various architectural parts, and they anticipated the spiritual impact the forms could, or they thought should, upon believers. So it was easy for them to appreciate the art because it was already part of their cultural heritage. So it works both ways.
You know, I think everyone who's on this panel is really interested in cultural heritage. And the questions that you're bringing up around history and how we make history, and also how the way we document makes history and influences how we see history. I mean, these are such important concepts for art historians to be thinking about today. And, you know, you're talking about photography, Jan, and Martin is really more looking at documents of how can we talk about lived experiences, enlivened ritual action and processions. But Adrian, I'm finally going to come around to you and ask you about drawings. So you recently wrote an article that was on preparatory drawings and also what Jan was just speaking about around restoration of the Abbey Church. Could you tell us about Fourmiger's project and then speak a little more broadly about the reuse of historical architecture and these imaginaries of the Romanesque?
I think it's interesting, I mean, to tie up also with what Jen was just saying. just to remind ourselves that these kind of terms that we're using are born specifically in the 19th century and specifically in the first half of the 19th century. So when you speak about Romanesque or even the term Byzantine as it is used in the 19th century in very complicated ways, is really something that is born in this early scholarship. Romanesque, for example, can be really traced back to the 1830s with Charles de Gerville, who is a correspondent also of Mérimée and other figures such as that. And let's say throughout the 1830s, we have first definitions really of what Romanesque is supposed to mean. And this is the first phase, which is before the actual restoration of the monument. So you have a first phase of really rediscovery and naming, labeling, as Jan has put it. And these labels are evolving, changing. Not all authors writing about these labels have the same idea about what they're supposed to mean. Mm-hmm. Many of them are also interchangeable. So, for example, Byzantine and Romanesque are perfectly interchangeable. They just mean that these are old buildings for certain authors. Mérimée, when he rediscovers the Abbey Church of Conques in the 1830s, is speaking of the Byzantine architecture that he finds lost in the middle of the Rouergue. So these are really problematic terms as well, which are born coined at this mm-hmm. very moment. And what's interesting to remind as well is just that this whole movement of rediscovery, the early, what is called medieval archaeology at the beginning, by the French scholars, and which is actually art history and history of architecture, is really something that is born in the beginning of the 19th century, after some of the more serious doubts which are raised about the state of the religious monuments of France. And I think it's important to recall, just for example, Chateaubriand at the very beginning of the 19th mm-hmm. century, who speaks, denounces the idea of these monuments ravaged since the revolution in ruins, they're empty of the faithful, vandalized, and also the idea that they are salvaged piece by piece for their stones. And this is really the beginning of a certain awareness for the modern notion of patrimony, so of cultural heritage as such. And it will take the entirety of the 19th century for it to be realized to a certain extent and sometimes even redestroyed worse by the restorations. So going back to Conques itself, we have this first phase of the rediscovery by Prosper Mérimée, who is very careful in the 1840s, saying that none of the state of the Abbey Church should be changed, so that the Abbey Church should be left as it is, except that it should be solidified. Let's say that the windows which were barred have to be reopened, the roof and the structural integrity of the building has to be restored, but nothing should be given to invention. And then we have this switch between the first half of the 19th century and the second half of the 19th century, where suddenly the restorers are much more prone to strong interventions on the buildings. And this is what happens specifically with Conques. So the notion of Disney landing is brought specifically by the interventions which are made in the times of the young architect who is sent to Conques in 1874. So we are very close to the period that Martin was describing of the revival also of the religious community and the revival of an actual use for the building. So when you're actually using the building, you somehow need also to have it in a state which is allowing it to be also pleasant for the community using it. And in the 1870s, this young architect, he's only 29 years old. He comes from Paris. He's formed at the Beaux-Arts, at the Fine Arts in Paris. He arrives there and he starts to draw several drawings, plans, and reconstruction ideas for the Abbey Church. And one of the things which I find always funny to a certain extent is that the state which is photographed today, or if you go to Conques today, the two large towers that he adds and which were supposed to represent really the ideal pilgrimage Western facade, the ideal French pilgrimage church, are just creations of Formigier. We don't know how high these two main towers were in the medieval period, and we don't even know if they were ever elevated. However, we know from drawings of the early 19th century that they are not there. So there is definitely something which is given to invention. And he goes even further. So my latest article on Formigier was working on a drawing that I found that had been to a certain degree forgotten of a neo-Byzantine project for the Abbey Church. So he wanted to put a much more pronounced dome in the middle of the transept to really have this kind of impression of a neo-Byzantine building. And this is something which is also related, especially for Saint-Front-Rigueux, which in the 1850s, throughout the 90s had been restored in a very kind of bombastic neo-Byzantine style by Paul Abadie, and which at the very end of the 19th century will arrive to also the Sacré-Cœur in Paris, which is this apogee of the neo-Byzantine in France. And the project that I'm leading now is trying to understand why you would use the style of a long-lost empire, the Byzantine Empire. Does it mean to use it also in the political climate or in the cultural, religious, and political climate of France from the middle of the 19th to the end of the 19th century? But for Kong, he doesn't realize this project, which means that Kong was not seen as a site good for a neo-Byzantine. It was just his fantasy of young architect. And in the end, he chooses a very, let's say, classical, neo-Romanesque way of restoring. And we know also today that the restorations are quite extensive.
Could you speak a little bit about what the difference is between the ultimate realization of the project and this imaginary that you've called neo-Byzantine? And could you just describe that drawing for us a little?
Yeah, this is a very difficult exercise, describing architecture only with words. He stays closer to a certain extent to the roofing system, so a straight roof, which is the roof of central lantern tower, a tour lanterne, which is the bell tower. And in the project, he wanted to add a huge dome, because the idea of the dome is what characterizes Eastern, Oriental to a certain extent, and chiefly Byzantine or Holy Land architecture in 19th century thought. So he wanted to put this kind of huge dome, which is covered with tiles as well, as you can see from the drawing. And this is an idea that he certainly takes from the restoration projects that are held in Saint-Front in Périgueux, by the architect Paul Abadie in the 1850s. He recreated the church of Saint-Front, at least the upper elevation of the church of Saint-Front of Périgueux, which had been transformed to a flat roof in the 18th century, restoring kind of huge domes. And this has both positive reactions, saying that this is a wonderful way to underline the particularity of Christianity in Gallia, so the particularity of this kind of ancient Christianity, which is linked to the late antique roots. And on the other hand, there are detractors also to this kind of architecture. Many of them call it the Great Mosque of Périgueux. So there are clearly very negative approaches as well. And if you go even further to the project for the Sacré-Cœur, there are very negative attitudes towards these kind of projects as well. So the Neo-Byzantine, a very ambiguous style to use. And this, I think, to a certain extent also explains why for Conque it was not seen as actually the way to go. And they kept a project which was much more rounded to a certain extent. If the addition of these two towers is really something which goes beyond the archaeological traces we have or beyond the construction phases to the invention, what Mérimée had had really strongly reprimanded in the first phase. I find it fascinating, and also just tying back again what Jen has said, that on the pictures of the Rouer Gromand of Zodiac, you have the two towers, and there is no critical discussion of the restorations which had happened at the end of the 19th century. So in the Rouer Gromand, suddenly the church with the two towers invented by Formigier becomes the actual Romanesque church, the perfect Romanesque church, whereas this is an invention which is actually not that old. It's maybe 50, 60 years old when Rouer Gromand is published. So this is also something which I think ties into the idea of architectural imaginaries and the way in which we take for granted what we have in front of the eyes. Also because the restoration is much less visible than in other places.
You started to talk about this idea of Disneylanding Conque, which drawing from this idea of, you know, creating an isolated, historicized village that still manages to live in the present. And I think this really influenced by these many 19th century interventions.
Absolutely. So, as I said, it's really this kind of key moment when both the terms are created and they enter into the mainstream of the art history up until today. I mean, Romanesque is a category that is used almost without questioning it historiographically by many scholars, and also absolutely right to have categories to speak about things, but we should never forget the way in which these categories are also created and labeled at key moments of the historiography. And then the Disneying, absolutely. I mean, even the way in which the main road which goes through Conque today has been created really in the 19th century. The ancient pathway, which is running around the Rue Charlemagne, gave a completely different perspective on the Abbey Church. You would arrive, discover it almost at the last moment going up, and now you have a road which is very straight, cutting through blocks of ancient medieval houses which were removed, and you arrive directly to the western facade if you arrive from the main street today. So even the idea of the picturesque that you find in the early 19th century drawings is emphasized by interventions on the urban tissue of the city. And I think that's absolutely fascinating, because you create, you know, an image d'épinal. I don't know if you know that term, the perfect image of a place by also intervening directly on the urban tissue.
Yeah, this idea of creating a perfect space, even better than it was in history, right? I mean, that's really in this mentality of people like Formigier.
The doctrine of Viollet-le-Duc is in his article on mission. He says, to restore properly is to restore a building to a state that may have never existed, but which is the general idea of how it should be. So the 19th century presumption of these architects is that they're restoring it even when parts had been lost, or even when parts had never been completed by the medieval architects, mm-hmm. to the state it should have been in.
Mm-hmm.
So restoring almost the soul of the building, which I think is also a fascinating idea.
I just wanted to add a couple of things, if I may. One is that the fact that the towers weren't there is part of showing that these monks were not critical. They had a ground plan in every book for each church, and they never put anything on a ground plan that showed it might have been different or that there were layers over time. It was just the ground plan, right? And so they got that from somebody, usually at the site, and then they reproduced it. And because these books were so influential, this is the plan, right? This is the original form. And the images of the towers at Konk are another example. But the other thing about Disneylanding that I think is important to keep in mind is, you know, it's not highly realistic and many times very unsophisticated. And I think that makes it very attractive. So books like the Zodiac that take these really close-up images of the heads of some of the figures on the tympanum, particularly those little figures that peek out from around the edges, that, you know, lift up the stone to look through. These kinds of photos make the place populate with interesting characters, almost like you would think of Disneyland having your favorite characters when you go to see the castle, and then there's Sleeping Beauty right there. These figures become familiar and they're not threatening. Even the devils in these things in many Romanesque sculptures are funny or fun looking, mm-hmm. you know? So there is a kind of way of presenting a very religious and serious site that is not mocking, but it lightens it and makes it palatable to a very large general public.
And it's interesting because I think there's this tension between the local religious community and then presenting these monuments and artworks as heritage that belongs to the world, but then also is very much still belonging to the local community. Janet, you're making me think and go back to the question about sources, you know, how this publication is disseminated. And I'd love it if you could speak about that, but also Martin, you're working on such a difficult topic, especially from an art historical perspective, to work on ritual and embodied performances. How did you get into working with those sources, Martin?
Those are great questions. As I've already mentioned, the trying to understand medieval rituals, I found out when I was looking at them that there was this 19th century procession happening as well, which used the medieval. And precisely through that, I was trying to find the materials so I could study these processions a little bit more. And there's this great source of information, which is the weekly journal of the Diocese of Rodez, Revue Religieuse de Diocese de Rodez, which was published from the 60s of the 19th century further on. Lucky for me as well, it's still in the archives of Aveyron, but at the same time, it's digitalized, which is absolutely helpful. And it's not only this journal, but other local materials which are there. What I did was actually reading almost the whole year of 1878, and it was fascinating, I think, the perspective of this Catholic community was, you know, and almost every opportunity you have to kind of criticize, you know, the parliament in Paris and Leon Gambetta's policies. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible source of information. For example, this kind of famous murder of Barré-Lévy's case happening in Paris in 1878, which was connected to Darwinism and like these modern ideologies. This journal obviously took it and said, oh, look, this is what's happening with your modern society, you know. So every opportunity they had, they used to critique what was happening in this new French Republic, the Third Republic. They also have the reports and programs of the renewal of the pilgrimage of Saint-Foy in Konk. Yeah, so it provides an incredible information for scholars who are interested.
I was just thinking that Jan has previously advocated for looking at the Zodiac publication, you know, and the material, maybe I can even say the materiality of the pages of the books. But then also, I mean, I know this is such a nuts and bolts kind of question, but this question about how do you do your research what do you go look at? You know, to have a digitized archive of all of these things together is so important for you and for anyone else who wants to work on the topic. So I think there's an interesting sort of difference in the ways that you're both approaching your source materials. And Adrian, how did you get access to those drawings, by the way? Are they digitized? Did you have to go somewhere?
They're in Paris, because most things in France are, of course, centralized. I was also in Rodez at the archives, which preserve more local things, but usually most things have to be sent to large institutions. So this is at the Archives du Patrimoine in Paris. But there are several other sites which have different pieces of information as well. This was also one of the issues, was to gather all these things. And part of the project wishes also to do a sort of database, which is going to gather a maximum of these materials. But we are still working on it now, and I hope that we will continue working on it also after the project has finished. I was wondering, Chris, maybe we have not heard you yet, because you are also working on this project. And you're also working on questions Disneylanding, perhaps to a certain extent, especially through contemporary performances. And maybe you can speak about this continuity also of the religious festivities. Martin told us a bit about them for the late 19th century. However, this is something which goes on until today. Maybe you could tell us a few words about what you are actually doing on this project.
Martin and I, we were lucky enough to be able to attend the Fête de Saint-Foix this year. And so that takes place in October around Saint-Foix's feast day on October 6th. The processions and events that we attended were mostly on the 7th and 8th, the Saturday and Sunday this year. The candlelight procession the day before the procession of the majesty and the objects out of the treasure. That was such an interesting experience, because walking through the village, through the areas that felt like they were the medieval history of the space, it gave it a kind of an urban texture and a kind of urban face of the medieval period. And the next morning, there's the procession of the majesty. So the reliquary of Saint-Foix is taken out of the treasury, which is actually technically a state museum. And, you know, as someone who is also very interested in questions around patrimony and cultural heritage, I was really interested in the development of this treasury as an exhibition space. Jean Terrelon made it into what he called an ambiance treasure in the 1950s. In 1955. And so there's this idea of the treasury as a kind of deactivated religious space that's run by the state, but then that is allowed to be reactivated once a year during the festivities, the Fête of Saint-Foix in October. And so all of the exhibition history actually revolves around this one week in the year where there's the octave of Saint-Foix, where the majesty is taken out and then displayed in the church. The processional cross is also walked. This is a Gothic processional cross. And it was really such a privilege to be there to witness this, because we also got to witness the kind of interactions between the museum workers and then the premonstratensians and the other people who are involved in the religious processions and ceremonies. And maybe what I'll say is that I just got to go to Paris. So I was able to go to the Louvre and look at the 2001 exhibition and actually read the letters and exchanges between, let's say, the mayor of Conques and the head of the Department of Medieval Objects at the Louvre, and the exchanges and negotiations that they had over how to put the exhibition together. There was a momentous exhibition in 2001 at the Louvre dealing with the treasure of Conques and presenting it as if it were the first time it was presented, although this is not the first exhibition that the treasury objects were in outside of Conques. It was also in an especially important exhibition in 1965. That was the Treasures of the Churches of France. And so there's a kind of tension between the objects that are in the treasury of Conques. I know we've mostly been focused on architecture, but since I have worked with Cynthia Hahn and I'm really invested in the objects that are there too, you know, these objects also participate in the kind of Disneylanding of Conques in the sense that they do participate in, they are still religious objects, but they're sitting at this interesting tension point between being objects in a museum and being desecularized, and then objects that are actively activated in religious liturgy, in ritual. That's where my interest in this betweenness and the sort of social relationships between local communities and state communities and how they intersect. Does that answer your question, Adrian?
Yes, more than a dozen. Thank you.
Thank you to everyone so much for having this conversation. And I'd like our final question to be, could you give one recommendation for someone who's interested in your topic? And could you also tell us about if you have any upcoming projects?
Well, I'm afraid I've written the and the more recent thing, there's a couple earlier articles in French, but I did a book on them. So that came out in 2015 from Penn State. It's called Zodiac, Making Medieval Modern. So there's that.
Great. Highly recommended from all of us, by the way.
What am I on right now? Besides the chapter for the Conque, I'm giving two talks this summer, both, again, coming out of my Zodiac studies. One is at the Materiality Conference in Lyon, where I'm going to talk exactly about what Chris, you mentioned, the double materiality of these photographs. They both exaggerate reality of the original object, and then they themselves are very richly material. So I'm going to talk about that. But then I'm giving another one in Leeds on exactly what Adrian was warning us about, and that is the definition of Romanesque. I'm going to try to redefine the name of the style Romanesque by looking at primarily all the widely divergent examples that the Zodiac books brought together and called Romanesque. They just sort of proved there is no consistency. So we're not going to change the word. You know, we're not going to come up with a new word that everyone's going to use. So what I'm looking at is the idea of Roman, not the image of Roman. The whole idea of being aerial, eclectic, inclusive, wide-ranging, multicultural, as the real way to read all these styles of people whose art came to form that of the High Middle Ages. The Byzantine Greeks and the Germanic Franks and the New Mayan Muslims and all that, that's what went into forming what eventually we call Romanesque. And so Romanesque then becomes sort of Rome-like, not in terms of the visual forms of that the Romans made, but of the idea of this amalgamation of all these peoples into one.
You're absolutely right. It's so hard to get away from this hard question of style and how much it shapes how we speak about things in art history. And I also love the other talk that you're giving too on double materiality. I mean, I think both of those sound fascinating. So I'm excited for that. And anyone who's at Leeds, go find Jan's panel and listen to it, because that sounds fantastic on the Romanesque. Yeah, thank you. Martin, maybe you could...
Thank you. So obviously, I don't want to put too many references here. Since we were talking a lot about this recherche sacrale, I think it's really appropriate to refer to Philippe Boutry's study from 2009. And it's about the restoration of relics in the 19th century France. I don't like to do it, but I would also perhaps refer to my own article, which was published recently in one of the Convivium Supplementums in 2023. It's called The Glorious Travel, where I'm dealing precisely with the reuse and ritual afterlife of this majesty of St. Foix and the Boniface casket, which was found in Conques in 1875. And I'm speaking a little bit about this, the triumphal procession from Rodez to Conques. I could refer to that as well. At least in Middle Ages, I will also refer to Eric Palazzo, Liturgy and Society in the Middle Ages, because it's kind of useful book. In terms of what lays in front of me now, these days, it is the incredible task of trying to publish my PhD, which that's what I'm trying to work on at the moment. But our other articles I have written, which are going to be published hopefully soon as well on Santa Maria Maggiore mosaic panels. I'm obviously already discussed participating in this great final volume on Conques. And Chris, you know very well, I'm trying to as well write something about the social sculptures and going further with this collaboration between various dioceses and the project of Bourret. So that's something to do in September. There are obviously some workshops and conferences. I'm going to Jena. There's the Mittelalter Forum of Art History in Germany. So I'm looking forward to that as well. So many things.
Absolutely. Actually, that does bring us to Adrian. Could you give your recommendations and then tell us about your upcoming projects?
Sure, yes. I love the idea of Janet, by the way, of Romanesque as the amalgamation of the post-Roman world. I think it's an idea which will very much upset all the people who wrote about Romanesque in the 19th century. So I like it particularly for that as well. And as for my recommendations, I spoke a lot about the neo-Romanesque. And there are two important books, unfortunately, both in French as well. The Important Study of Xavier Barral, Contre l'art roman, Against Roman Art, an essay about the reinvented past, if you're happy to read French. And there's another book, unfortunately, in French as well, by Jean Nayrol, which came out the same year, which is also on the invention of Romanesque art. These two books are a good basis to understand really this kind of rediscovery and invention of the term in the 19th century. If you want something on the Neo-Byzantine, there are several small articles which exist. I can again refer also to an article I wrote recently about the question of Byzantine or Neo-Byzantinisms in Conques as a sort of form of religious medievalism as well. So the whole project of Formiger, this was published in Convivium last year. And there are several great books. One book that I generally recommend if you want to also understand the dynamic, how Neo-Byzantine or the art of the Byzantine or the Eastern Roman Empire was rediscovered, the wonderful book on Hagia Sophia by Robert Nelson. And then there's a beautiful book, if you look at beautiful pictures, is the book by J.B. Bullen, Byzantium Rediscovered. And this is a Phaidon book, which has wonderful images and wonderful explanation of the Byzantine revival of the 19th, early 20th century. Also these kind of literary impressions of the idea of Byzantium, which I have spoken, of course, a bit less about, but which I'm going to be focusing quite a lot in the next 3 years, because I'm, as I said at the beginning, the PI of a project on Neo-Byzantine arts, especially in France in the second half of the 19th century until the very early 20th century. But I have colleagues which are involved in this project, which are going to also venture to the reception of the Neo-Byzantine. And one of my goals is really to look at the use of these typologies of historicist architecture also outside of context where we look at them. So, for example, in Algeria, which at that time under French colonial rule, and it becomes an architecture also of power, which is strongly tied with political ideas of the colonizers towards the colonized. So I think that there are still very interesting questions also about how historical styles or neo-styles are used also as colonizing instruments or instruments of colonization.
Thank you. All of your projects are fascinating. I especially am interested in how you're going to connect looking at these colonialist architectures and then their relationships with different quote-unquote neo-styles. I guess we'll wrap up. I would like to give three recommendations for readings. If anyone is interested in the work that I've done on exhibitions, there's not many texts that are working within this cultural heritage, exhibition histories. There is another person on our project, Philippe Cordes, who is working on a chapter that also is dealing with more modern to contemporary Conques and Soulage, but I wanted to call out, he has a great article on Charlemagne as the father of Europe. He frames this 1965 exhibition in Aachen around Charlemagne as a father of Europe and the idea of European patrimony versus German patrimony versus French patrimony. I do want to say, since it's in German, I thought I would give an alternate recommendation for anyone who's reading more in English. This is a recommendation I would give to everyone, which is Diana Taylor's The Archive and the Repertoire. Most people do not approach this text through the lens of cultural heritage or patrimony, but I think it really speaks to the relationship between embodied memory and cultural heritage, how cultural heritage can be found in the body. Usually people would talk about this as intangible cultural heritage, which is a particular UNESCO designation. But The Archive and the Repertoire is a fantastic book. I think it really speaks to both what I'm working on and also what Martin is working on. So if you're interested in performance studies and their meeting point between art history, I highly recommend this as a sort of jumping in there kind of book. Finally, I should also say the article that really impacted me thinking about medievalisms was William Diebold's article on the Nazi Middle Ages. It's a short read. The ideas are interesting, even though I've moved maybe away from his work on this idea of shallow medievalism that he speaks about in this article. I think it's just a perfect entry point to thinking about cultural heritage, history, and its presence in the current moment, in the contemporary moment. So those would be my three recommendations. And then in terms of what I'm doing now, I would say my next upcoming projects are I am editing a volume with different visions. That is on this concept that Martin brought up around social sculpture in the Middle Ages. It's sort of at the intersection between intangible cultural heritage, embodied experience, and object histories through this kind of paradigm of social sculpture, which is a concept that the artist Joseph Beuys originally invented, but we're trying to expand that into the medieval period. So in some ways, I'm looking from the medieval perspective to the present, and then in other ways, I'm hoping to look from the present into the past. Finally and lastly, I'd like to thank all of you. Thank you so much for having this conversation. I feel like it was really, really productive.
Really good, Curiel. Interesting. I think it's fun that we came from four completely different parts of the world. It's just so great what we can do now. And it proved what Adrian is talking about in terms of the reach of this project.
We hope that the monograph will be also, let's say, widely available and a pleasure for everyone to read. So this is also an early commercial for a book which will come out at the very end of the year. Most likely be available only at the beginning of next year, but maybe pre-orders can open soon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.